Waterloo.
Welcome to Waterloop, the podcast that explores solutions for sustainability and equity in water. I'm Travis Loop, co-host for this episode.
And I'm co-host Maya Richard Craven. This episode is part of the Color of Water series, which features interviews with diverse experts from communities across the country. This series is a collaboration between Waterloop and the Water Hub.
This is episode number 214, Charles River in a Changing Climate. The iconic Charles River, central to Boston's suburbs and urban landscape, faces significant environmental challenges, including the impacts of climate change. The problems, such as flooding, hit hardest in downstream areas that are often disadvantaged communities. Dira Johanif, with her roots in the diverse environments of Malaysia, from bustling cities to the lush rainforests of Borneo, brings a unique perspective to her role as a senior climate resilience associate at the Charles River Watershed Association in Massachusetts. Her international experiences have shaped her approach to water stewardship and environmental justice in the U.S. Dira's work centers on implementing nature-based solutions and spearheading collaborative initiatives like the Charles River Climate Compact, which demonstrates the essential role of regional cooperation in building climate resilience. To communicate the river's issues to diverse audiences across the Boston region, Dira leverages storytelling and community engagement.
You're in the Waterloop.
Dira, we are so excited to have you here on the podcast as part of our Color of Water series.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here today, too.
Well, why don't we get started? So first off, Dira, what got you into this work?
Yeah, so currently I'm the Senior Climate Resilience Associate with the Charles River Watershed Association. And, you know, I've had this question asked a lot. And, you know, for me, I was never really a budding environmentalist, or I wasn't really a kid that loved nature growing up per se, but I did grow up moving around a lot as a kid due to my dad's job in the tourism industry in Malaysia. And that led me to being exposed to a number of different, you know, landscapes and environments growing up, from, you know, city landscapes in Malaysia, being, you know, growing up in the Scandinavian town center in, you know, Stockholm, Sweden, but also smaller historic towns in Malaysia. And then in my kind of last few years in high school, we had moved to, you know, the Borneo side in East Malaysia. And while I was living in Borneo, I got more exposed to the ecotourism aspects of my dad's job, which meant that I got to go, you know, see the rainforest, go cave trekking, and really understand the attraction of nature for tourists. And then also getting introduced to indigenous communities in Malaysia and how they lived with nature. I wasn't really thinking about climate change and its impacts on humans or how humans have caused climate change until I was in my last 2 years of high school when I got to take an environmental management class. And even then, it was really more focused on how humans can manage and control our environment to deal with climate change. And it was very focused on the global scale solution. So it really wasn't until I was in grad school at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, that I really started thinking about local impacts and local solutions and how much impact local projects can have on the communities that I live in or my family and friends live in. And so by the time I graduated from grad school and also had a few years of experience in communicating climate and marine science to the public in my volunteer role at the New England Aquarium as an educator, I knew that I wanted to work in a space that helped bridge the gap between, you know, the academic and scientific world and with actual community members impacted by climate change. And that's kind of how, that's what led me to the Charles River Watershed Association.
We might just have to like detour the whole podcast and talk about cave trekking in Malaysia and hanging out in the rainforest and just those experiences. That sounds awesome. And what a great like juxtaposition to have that experience and then also spend time like in Stockholm, which is one of like Europe's great cities. And now you're in one of the US's great cities, Boston, and its kind of iconic river, the Charles. Could you just describe the Charles River and the watershed there?
Yeah. The Charles River, you know, it's actually traditionally known by Native Americans as Quinnipiquin, which meant the meandering one. And like you said, it is a pretty iconic and popular river in Boston. Today, if people come to Boston or tourists come to Boston, they might think about how pretty the Charles River is, mostly, you know, based on their experience in the lower basin, where they might be walking along the Charles River Esplanade. And that might be the extent of their experience with the river. But the river is actually 80 miles long and starts in a town west of Boston called Hopkinton. And it meanders through 20 odd towns before it actually reaches the Boston Harbor. And we like to compare the river's beginning and end to the Boston Marathon route, which also starts in Hopkinton and then ends in Boston. But the watershed itself, you know, which is the land that captures the water that ends up in our streams, ponds, and ultimately the river, is a little over 300 square miles. And there is a total of 35 towns that make up the watershed with over 1 million watershed residents. And when we look at the watershed itself, the landscape of the watershed, upstream in the upper watershed, there is growing development in some town centers. There's also a major highway that's kind of right along the river. When you get to the middle watershed, it's pretty rural, and there are a lot of undeveloped lands, as well as this really cool network of, you know, 8,000 acres of wetlands that were conserved back in the 80s by the Army Corps of Engineers in response to devastating impacts of hurricanes in the mid-1950s. And then when you get to the downstream, lower watershed, where you find, you know, City of Boston, City of Cambridge, this is where the landscape in our watershed gets more urbanized and developed, like many other urban rivers in the country. And you get, you know, a lot more impervious surfaces. You get large highways, you get your multi-lane roads, your sidewalks, and your building tops, and you have a lot less of that permeable green spaces.
That's so interesting. And, you know, I'm really interested in kind of how the climate crisis is impacting the Charles River. So what are the climate challenges and impacts for the Charles River? And what are environmental justice considerations in the watershed?
Now, the climate challenges and impacts that we face in the Charles River watershed are very similar to other urban rivers in the country. When we take a look at the river's history, you know, it's important to consider that when European colonizers arrived in what is, you know, now Massachusetts, they saw the river and they decided to harness it for industrialization. So there's, you know, dams that were built on the river. And in fact, the Charles River is unique in the sense that we've actually lost our tidal estuary, or where the mouth of the river meets the ocean, because we have the Charles River Dam that was built in 1908. And that dam today is considered a flood control dam for the river. And while dams still pose a threat to the river's ecosystem, today, you know, one of the biggest threats to the river quality and river health is stormwater runoff, which is driven by an increase in impervious surfaces in the watershed and exacerbated by climate change. Because when we increase the amount of surfaces like paved sidewalks, roadways, and rooftops, all of which are impermeable and will not allow rainwater to soak through, that means that more rainwater or stormwater will flow off of those surfaces and pick up pollutants like litter, leaves, dog poop, you know, car oil, things like that, and carry it into our storm drains. And many people have this misconception that the storm drains and sewer drains are, you know, one of the same. And anything that goes into a pipe system will magically go to a treatment facility and then turn into cleaner water. But in reality, you know, stormwater runoff that ends up in the storm drain in our watershed will, you know, typically eventually get discharged or dumped into the river untreated. So it brings in all of that pollutants and excess nutrients that cause harm to the river and create cyanobacteria blooms, excess E. coli levels, you know, and invasive species growth, which all, you know, lowers water quality in the river and prevents safe and safe recreational opportunities. But another impact of high percentages of impervious surfaces in our landscape is the increase of inland flooding. So for our watershed, a lot of the wetlands and riverbanks of the Charles, especially in the lower basin, you know, where Boston, Newton, and Cambridge are, were filled in to make space for a growing population, I think, since the 1600s. So we've taken up space where water used to be, and then we've replaced our, you know, pervious wetlands, hills, and green spaces with impervious surfaces. And then in the Northeast, we're expecting to get more intense storms with climate change. So with that, you know, we're thinking about where will the water go? They'll flood our streets, our buildings, our sidewalks, you know, in our homes, because we've built systems that were adapted, or systems and infrastructure that were adapted to the climate of like 20, 30 years ago, which obviously are no longer suitable for the environment we're in today, or, you know, 50, 100 years from now. And when we think about who is vulnerable to flooding in our watershed, we have to consider that most of the environmental justice and climate vulnerable populations in our watershed, you know, based on federal and state definitions, are in our downstream communities. So where you have a lot of those impervious surfaces. And so for CRWA, we like to take a watershed scale view when thinking about issues of climate change, flooding impacts and solutions to flooding, you know, thinking about where should those solutions be implemented and who will it benefit, with, you know, a focus of those benefits and the climate resiliency aspects of it, you know, benefiting our environmental justice and climate vulnerable populations.
That's a terrific overview, and just shines a light on how another community in America is being affected by climate change. It's just everyone is seeing something happen. And a lot of times when people think of Boston, they think it's a lot of affluence in Boston, right? But there are environmental justice communities there, again, on the short end of the stick, right? Being disproportionately impacted.
Right.
So let's pivot a little bit to the solution side of things. When it comes to climate resilience, what kind of projects are being advanced in the for the Charles River and for those communities that you just talked about?
Yeah, so within our work, we focus on nature-based solutions or strategies, which are basically solutions that, you know, utilize or mimic or enhance natural features or processes in the environment to promote resiliency to our changing climate. A slogan that we use a lot is bringing nature back, but I also like the phrase engineering nature back into our environment, because essentially we have built, you know, this far an environment that really lacks the ability to bounce back in a safe and timely and cost-effective manner, because we have removed or altered systems that would naturally help us do that. And so nature-based solution projects that we focus on in the watershed are green stormwater infrastructure, or GSI, and river restoration projects, because these projects really focus on bringing or engineering nature back into our environment, so that we do have those systems that can manage the extreme storms and heat we are expecting. You know, some really cool projects include, you know, installation of rain gardens and infiltration chambers in an upper watershed municipality of ours in the past 2 years that, you know, will now help filter stormwater runoff and help reduce local flooding impacts. And then as well, through one of our projects called the Charles River Flood Model, we've also identified over 50 opportunities for flood mitigation in the watershed, with, you know, priority communities that would ideally include wetland restorations, you know, increasing pond storage capacity, and even more rain gardens. And, you know, I also want to note that another aspect of resiliency for the work that we do is to make sure that the projects are projects that the community wants to see and that will work for the community. So the project process for us really includes working intentionally with the community to understand the issues that they're facing and then designing a solution that makes sense and also meets the needs for that space, and also have, you know, a maintenance schedule that won't burden municipal staff, because, you know, maintenance of these systems are just as important as, you know, putting them into the ground in the first place.
Absolutely. And I wanted to ask just a follow-up question about resiliency. How are you taking a regional approach to resilience?
Yeah, so in Massachusetts, you know, we don't really have regional agencies that work at the scale to address climate change impacts like many other, you know, counties in other states in the country. And so instead, towns and cities are responsible for addressing climate change needs within their municipal boundaries. But we know that climate change doesn't respect man-made boundaries, right? And flood water or storm water, it's not going to stop at political lines. And so to us, it makes a lot of sense that if we want to address flooding impacts in the watershed, we should be looking at how water moves in the entire watershed during a storm event. And so in 2019, our organization, CRWA, established the Charles River Climate Compact, which is a regional partnership of 28 out of the 35 watershed towns and cities. And the Climate Compact's mission is to work collaboratively to increase climate resiliency for people and the natural ecosystems in the watershed by taking this regional approach at a watershed scale to implement climate adaptation and mitigation solutions. And in 2020, the group launched the Charles River Flood Model, which is a watershed scale computer model that shows you when and where flooding will occur with climate change, and also helps identify and design solutions to help our communities prepare. And so this, you know, taking a regional watershed scale view allows us to determine the most cost-effective solutions and then to also equitably address flooding concerns by considering upstream impacts on downstream communities, because obviously water moves downhill and these 35 towns are connected to one another because they are all part of this watershed ecosystem. And so we're in year 4 of this modeling project, and we're continuously learning and updating the model to find the best solutions based on the most up-to-date climate data and maps that are available for us to use. And we've seen that within our watershed, there is more space, you know, upstream than downstream to implement large-scale mitigation solutions that would benefit multiple communities, including the vulnerable residents, you know, downstream. And, you know, this approach where towns talk to each other and plan together also makes sure that, you know, make sure that resiliency efforts are not redundant. And we're, you know, in Massachusetts, we're seeing watershed scale collaborative efforts like this that are led by watershed organizations becoming more and more popular across the state, which is also a really exciting thing to see.
You mentioned early in the conversation that there's about a million people that live in the Charles River watershed. And obviously your work and the health of the river, all this is important to the community. How do you communicate with them? A lot of your work is pretty scientific, technical, policy focused, but how do you take that approach of communicating with the people out there?
Yeah, that's a really great question. But I also find it a really tricky question to answer because there are so many ways to communicate science to the public. And like you said, at CRWA, as an advocacy organization, a big goal of ours is to translate scientific data into digestible and relevant information for our stakeholders, whether they are decision makers, homeowners, renters, or voters. You know, we want to make sure that our information can be received by everyone. For me, when I prepare to communicate science to the public, you know, the first thing that I want to know is who is my audience, you know, their language or languages, you know, will I need translations or a translator, you know, their familiarity with the topics, you know, do I need to cover basics, terminology, definitions, what setting will I be in? Are we going to be in person or virtual? You know, how will they be receiving my information? You might also think about what age group they are, because that might determine specific interests or maybe what their priorities might be. And for me, I'm a really, really big component for good visuals and graphics, because they can really help tell a story rather than just straight facts that might bore or intimidate people. You know, as scientists or engineers, we like to use numbers or jargon within like the academic field, you know, to be consistent with other practitioners, you know, for example, using the term 2070 100-year storm event. And numbers can be really powerful, but when communicating science to the public, you want to consider, you know, what other numbers or ways you can say what you want to say and lower the barrier of communication and make it relevant to your audience. So instead, you know, you might say, this map shows you a future storm event in 2070 that can bring 11 inches of rain in 24 hours, which is 3 inches more than what we would get today. And then maybe use a graphic or image that creates a picture of how 3 inches of rain can mean road closures for emergency vehicles or your storm drain getting backed up. It's really important to find that common ground with your audience, you know, with what they're concerned about. And because that's a really important step to communicating science and then even, you know, getting that to lead to action. And I've learned a lot in my time at CRWA and watching how others communicate. And I definitely still have a lot to learn, but a big takeaway I've found is that it's really, really important to listen for many of the processes that we do with our projects and listen to many voices and experiences and pausing for questions. And, you know, there's a lot in the, you know, engagement world where, you know, you might want to change your language so that it meets, you know, folks who might have like a third grade reading level or something like that. But, you know, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't also leave room for the public to ask you more technical questions, because you never, you know, want to assume the experiences and knowledge that the public will bring when they have those conversations with you. And some of my best, you know, conversations and engagement around community or communicating science to the public have been back and forth conversations where we ask each other, you know, what's important to us. Why does this matter to you? And then sharing those facts with stories and experiences.
Yeah, I wanted to just, you know, ask you a little bit about, you know, your experience in climate and how you've seen that. You know, I'm going off script here, but I love to ask this question. You know, what, not only, you know, you have a connection to Malaysia, but also, you know, how is all of your work on these areas influenced by that connection? And also, have you seen the climate crisis and its impacts in Malaysia?
Yeah, so that's, you know, a really great question, because for me, I've moved around a lot. And so obviously, I've experienced a lot of different cultures and settings. And for the work that I do at CRWA, where there is a lot of community engagement and connecting and talking to people, I think that my connection and my experiences, you know, with my roots in Malaysia have influenced the way I interact or get to interact with our stakeholders, especially as an immigrant myself. And, you know, that's not to say that my colleagues aren't doing a fantastic job, because they are, but I think even from the way that I look and my name and, you know, not really growing up as someone who's always been around the Charles, when I go into different watershed communities who may have historically experienced environmental planning or climate resiliency planning or engagement with, you know, non-BIPOC people, I think there is a space that I hold that expands our work and our impact just a little bit more. And I think this is more true in face-to-face interactions, you know, whether I'm at tabling events or public networking events or even conferences, that really help lower the barrier to communicating what we need to communicate. And, you know, I also think that my experiences growing up in Malaysia, especially at, you know, at my grandparents' homes, which were more traditional in villages and were designed, you know, to be more efficient for airway or flooding by, you know, having, you know, blocks of brick with holes in it, or they might be elevated on wooden stilts, you know, to be adaptable to flooding during monsoon season, I think allows me to, despite my, you know, lack of academic training in architecture or engineering, really look at climate adaptation and resiliency in the Northeast, especially when we are expecting more storms and sea level rise, you know, to look at innovative solutions like floating houses, you know, floating waterfronts and things like that, you know, as not only innovative, but actually doable and achievable because other cultures have already been doing them and I've seen them. And I think that can be really powerful, especially in our advocacy work. And in terms of, you know, climate change impacts in Malaysia, you know, all of my family is back in Malaysia. And so I definitely get to hear and see their experiences with climate change. And so, you know, Malaysia, especially in the city, like many other cities, are so impervious. And so when we do get, you know, those big rain events, those monsoon events, a lot of Malaysia, our highways and roads do get flooded. And a lot of folks, you know, still struggle with, you know, heat impacts in different parts of Malaysia because we are so urbanized. Even the neighborhood that my parents live in, we might have some really nice big trees, but for the most part, it is so paved over because, you know, there's, you know, still a mindset, or we've built with, you know, previously with a mindset that concrete and asphalt is a really easy way for us to divert monsoon water or storm water into ditches and drain and get it out of the neighborhoods. But, you know, the other side of that is now we have neighborhoods that are really hot, and Malaysia is already hot to begin with. And so with climate change, you know, that's really being felt in a lot of different communities.
Super perspective. You know, like I love the idea that you've learned these lessons or seen these things on the other side of the world and can bring that perspective to the Charles River watershed and the Boston area. But thank you so much. This was a super conversation, very informative, and we look forward to following your work for sure.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Yucho.
Thank you.
Waterloop. Thank you for listening to the podcast. This was part of the Color of Water series, a collaboration between Waterloop and WaterHub. To find all episodes, sign up for email updates, and connect on social media, visit waterloop.org.
Waterloop, Waterloop, Waterloop.